This week on Decentralized, drone tech, the future of warfare. Then we talk to Jonathan Mayo Buttry of 3D Robotics.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Chaz Ferguson.
I'm James Walter.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
So something we've never talked about in the show before is drone technology. We've talked about everything from 3D printing to Bitcoin to pro wrestling to libertarianism to economics. And for some strange reason, we've never come around to drone technology, possibly one of the coolest things out there right now and possibly one of the most visible spaces in which principle of decentralization actually could be really interesting. And where this field has a huge potential for actually being something that's used by individuals now instead of as it's been so far, governments and larger entities. So it's a very exciting space, and I'm really surprised we're just coming around to it. What are you thinking about the space, Tony? What do you see as some of the really interesting use cases out there? Are you a drone maniac?
I'm not a drone maniac, but I think it's cool. What's weird is there was some time about a decade ago that the term drone came into use over remote control helicopter, because remote control helicopters existed for decades, but they were very hard to control because I had one. I really thought they were cool. And now it seems like they're getting easier and easier to just control, because believe me, if you bought a remote control helicopter a decade or 20 years ago, those things were not easy to control. The learning curve was steep. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done, was trying to keep that thing not to crash into everything that it was around. Now it seems like they're working really well. Like, you can get great shots. Amateurs can just really do really cool things with it. For some reason, though, it seems like a lot of people are scared by it. Which is natural, like a lot of the things we talked about that you mentioned, Bitcoin being the big one. People are kind of scared of new technologies. And I remember 6 months ago, there was a big thing on Reddit where someone, this girl was being recorded, or she thought she was being recorded via drone, and she actually assaulted this guy that was, he was like 16, that was trying to, just record on the beach. And that's how the reaction is from people that don't understand it, where, you're really going to see that. And I think you're going to see more of that, people just getting outraged. And it kind of sucks, but what are you going to do? Eventually they'll kind of come around. There's really a lot of cases for it, for exploration, for places, humans maybe wouldn't be able to reach, or it would be difficult for humans to reach, to filming movies, to getting a crowd, filming disaster areas and seeing which areas need the most help. There's so many cool things that they can do. And I think the positives really outweigh the negatives very, very highly.
Yeah, no, it's a great point, exactly. I do remember in the case of when flight was really first developed, there were huge conflicts over the property rights and how property rights were considered in court. So for the longest time, prior to really the advent of commercial flights, people generally assumed that you kind of had property rights up into the air, basically, from where you were, from where your land was. No one ever really thought of the possibility of intruders coming in through the air. So it took a while for that litigation and common law kind of practice to work itself out in like the early 1900s. And it's interesting to see how it's happening here. I remember like hearing a lot about how like ranchers out west were going to shoot down drones flying over their land and stuff, and very funny stuff. You're totally right. It's definitely got its controversial edge to it. Like a lot of interesting technologies and a lot of bad technologies, like genuinely bad. But I'm pretty excited about it. And like you said, it's a broad category. It's not just things that fly in the air, I had remote controlled helicopters and airplanes too, and I never considered how useful they might be one day. But it's things, going into the water. So unmanned submarines sort of thing, any kind of, UAV, I think is the terminological term, though the A in that may be airborne. I'm not sure. In any case, just having robots to go where we can't go, as you said, is going to open up a lot of possibilities to us. And one thing you didn't mention, which I'm pretty excited about, again, if it works out, is its applications in commerce. Amazon's a big mover in this space. Obviously, a lot of people probably have had their attention drawn to drones because of this. Even more so than by policies of, say, a government using it for weaponry. They know now that Amazon is wanting to do the exact opposite and deliver goods and things people want. right to your doorstep. So I think Amazon actually released a video pretty recently of sort of the concept for this. They come up with some issues against FAA as far as how they can use it, but it's really, really marvelous. And it's another step toward, you know, just sort of that international kind of instant way of getting things you want, you know, and definitely you can definitely have some legitimate concerns about a company like Amazon getting a fleet of drones for sure. But on the other hand, you know, it's definitely if this is something that's open up to everyone and it's sort of a free market for competition, it's an exciting thing. And I look forward to getting my morning cereal and newspaper delivered to me via drone from Amazon or another competitor or just my own personal drone.
Yeah. The question is, do you have to tip a drone? I don't know. But with all that said, it's interesting that you brought up remote control submarines, because over the last week I heard something and I read something about Nikola Tesla about 100 years ago. It's easy to say it when you talk about Tesla about 100 years ago. Actually created the first RC-controlled boat, which he actually claimed would be the end of warfare. Obviously, that was wrong. But I think the ideal was right. You know, like how is war going to react to this? And it's funny, well, not funny, but it's odd that it's 100 years later, and you know, war's still war. Drones are used a lot more. I don't know how I feel about that use. Like that's the one use where I'm like, you know. Just what I don't like war, but most people don't. But it's very confusing because yes, it's saving people's lives, but it's also harming people's lives. And you know, it's a lot to me. It's a lot different from a human pulling a trigger when they're right there via versus a human pulling a trigger via video feed. And that I think when it comes to warfare, I think is kind of difficult. And it's something where if they've been working on this for 100 years. And this is something where now the flights are easier. They can actually deliver them. I think it's been like this for probably about a decade because the military has much more sophisticated technology than, you know, the civilian class would or the private industry would. Where is it going to go next, right? I think it could actually lead to the end of war. But I also think that for that to happen, other countries that don't have any kind of financial backing for things like this, they need to develop this technology or they need to have access to it. And that's where I think, you know, open sourcing, it's good for humanity, actually. And, you know, making sure they have the access to it, too. And people say, oh, that's anti-American, giving the enemies a secret. It's like, no, it's not anti-American at all. It's saying, I don't want war. I don't want anyone dead. I don't care if they're American. I don't care if they're Afghani. I don't care if they're Iraqi. I don't care if they're Australian. I just, you know, it doesn't matter to me. I want as many lives saved as I can. And if that's the next step of warfare is drones taking each other out, I'm cool with that. Because that's just broken machinery. Like, that's fine. You know, that doesn't hurt anyone. I mean, other than people's wallets, you know, that are investing in it. And it's really going to be interesting to see what this is like in 25 years and to see what kind of effect it does. Because I don't think it will end war, but I think it has a possibility to reduce the negative impacts of it. And that's huge. That's really huge if you think about it. But again, Tesla said this 100 years ago, and that was 100 years ago, and it really hasn't went that far. So maybe it won't. It's human nature that you're arguing with there, and that's very difficult.
Yeah, I think you put it really well that like these major advances in weaponry that always give an upper hand to basically the more powerful party, it's always posed as a solution to war that, you know, now this party has this weapon, no one else can rise to challenge it, and that scales won't escalate. There won't be any kind of weapons escalation. No, there's no such thing as an arms race. At least, you know, people didn't imagine that. There's an essay by George Orwell, and I don't know the name of it, and I probably haven't read it. I do need to be honest there, but we'll link it in the show notes. That basically, kind of looking at how weapons have played a role in human history and especially in the balance of power. This definitely had something to play in his writing of the book 1984. But his basic thesis is that really, you know, 1700s, 1800s, you had a musket and basically the king's soldiers had a musket. It was a pretty level playing field between everyone. The technology was level. The technology was equally affordable for all parties involved. So that guaranteed a certain sort of a check on the power, you know, group of people could claim or the damage they can inflict in terms of, you know, lives lost. But now you have things like nuclear weapons, which only really powerful, really, really wealthy groups can have, governments in this case. And we recently, you know, observed the 70th anniversary of the the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which, you know, kind of just was a stark reminder of this era. That was almost, again, 70 years ago. Where are we now? And I guess I don't know if we're much better off in that case. But to look at, you know, and to look at things like drones, I guess, the same kind of power imbalance exists. Like you say, you know, third world countries don't have drones. That's why drones are used. In the case of nuclear weapons, I mean, they're so relatively powerful in a geopolitical perspective is that most third world, second world countries don't have them, at least not to the extent that countries like, you know, United States or Russia. Same thing with drones, I'm guessing. And while it'd be really cool to see just drones duking it out and like watch a remote controlled gunfight, I think ultimately those things just serve as proxies for human lives, whether it's the lives of the people who can't afford drones to fight back, or the lives of the people, you know, who are maybe forced to fund them. It's not inspiring confidence, because I guess, you know, one of the main ethical concerns is that it takes skin out of the game of killing. So when you have to pull a trigger, it's a much more traumatic experience. It's a much more costly experience for everyone involved. When you're just sitting behind a computer, it makes it a lot easier. So I'm not super hopeful for that. But what I am hopeful about, kind of maybe close the loop on my comments here, because I have a lot of thoughts on this, is that like the internet, like a lot of things, you know, these technologies are often initially monopolized by people who want to kill people with technologies. It's sad, and I don't mean to laugh. Actually, it's really sad. I mean, if you look at nuclear research, and you know, before nuclear power, you had nuclear weapons. Nuclear power may be a really cool thing going into the future, but it's horrible to see where it came from. And I'm not saying it's necessary, but look at that. Look at the internet. Look at a lot of medical research. Look at, you know, the space programs. It's the same kind of cycle, but what's hopeful about it is that people, life finds a way, and people find a way of making things that were originally made to destroy into something that's really, really good. And I hope that's what happens to drones. I hope it's used to rescue people. I hope they're used to rescue people. I hope they're used to deliver goods. I hope they're used to make really cool movies. Maybe not like a new Transformers movie with a lot of over-the-top explosions. But I think it's going to be really fun. And that's why I'm hopeful about, I guess, technologies in general, is that, again, people always find a way to decentralize them, to make them more freely available, and to do creative and beautiful things with them.
Absolutely. And first of all, there's so many things I want to comment on what you said. The first thing is, I believe the piece you're talking about by George Orwell was You and the Atomic Bomb. I did a little quick Googling while you were speaking. I believe so. I don't know 100%, but it seems like that's that. It does go into
feudalism. Right. Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah, it goes into feudalism, the use of muskets, and it's interesting. It's very interesting. And one of the other interesting things that you talked about was nuclear power. It seems like that's an issue where when I hear – it's almost like GMOs. I hear a lot of negative speak on it, and I go, nuclear power is awesome. Like, nuclear power is a great thing. It's a really good thing. Safety around it can be a problem, see Three Mile Island, you know, all that. But nuclear power is a great, great thing. Nuclear bombs, not so much, but it was inevitable, I believe. I truly do. But when it comes to nuclear power, that's really something where, you know, that has always been one of those issues where there's a lot of people against it because it has the word nuclear in it. I really think it's that. It's not, you know, this is a new power source that we can have. It's just that people hear that word nuclear and they connotate it with the bomb. They don't connotate it with this is a cool new energy source. They think if this is used to destroy this many people, like what happens if it was called the machine gun power generator or something? It would have an equally as negative thought. It would be stupid, obviously. It's a bad example, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just that thought really gives them negative opinions. And this is getting off the topic of drones, but that really fascinated me when you said that about nuclear power, because it's one of those issues where there's very few things like that right now that are very controversial but are really doing a lot of good, and people kind of have a negative opinion of them, and maybe they shouldn't, and in fact, most of the time, I don't think they should. And that's why I said there's a lot of things I want to reply to what you just said with in regards to drones. I think drones are another one, because when most people first heard the word drone, it was either from a bombing in Baghdad, or it was playing Call of Duty, or it had something to do with warfare and people dying. they don't, you know, hearing the drones that deliver items, they people a lot of times will think, oh, that's eliminating a human job. Well, that's inevitable. And that's something humanity in general needs to kind of admit, that we're hitting a tipping point, if we haven't hit it already, where the jobs that are being created are not enough, that are being destroyed by technology. And it's only going to get worse. This is only my opinion, but it's shared by a lot of others. And it really is, it does have a negative kind of thought. When people think about drones, they think negatively, hence people freaking out when they're being recorded by one. And if people are out in public and they're at a park and someone's recording with a drone, I have no problem. I'm like, what's your problem? You're in a public area. People can film you, whatever, doing it. A human can film you. So why couldn't a drone? Now, if you're in your house, you're not going to be filmed by a drone, most likely, unless you have the windows open. And it really gives you a different perspective on privacy. It gives you a different perspective on what exactly is right regarding to being in public. Do drones kill the paparazzi? I would love it if they did. I would love if the drones ended the paparazzi movement, because guess what? You no longer need to follow these people. You don't need tragedies like Princess Diana to happen, because I don't get paparazzi. I don't get that cult of celebrity that much, but I do know that they make a lot of money doing it. So if there's money, money talks. And there's a lot of ramifications for drones. There's so many that we're not even beginning to discuss. And that when I just mentioned paparazzi, I bet a lot of people haven't even thought of that regarding drones, but it's just cracking the surface. And we're going to see it if getting bigger and bigger as the technology gets cheaper and cheaper. And you're going to see a lot more people using it for recreation, for filming, for whatever they want. And eventually, you know, people will kind of give in and they'll say, you know, it's a tool like anything else. There's good and there's bad. I really am wondering how it will end up being in, you know, like I said earlier, 10 to 25 years. What will be the ultimate use case for the drone? Will it be warfare? Will it be delivery? Because I think delivery is a better use case than war. I really do. And that's what interests me the most about it, and where it's going, and where, you know, where it'll be in 5, 10, 15. I would love to have like check marks so I can see it in 5 years, see it in 10 years, see it in 15, and just kind of see how much it's evolved.
Totally. I love the idea you came up with there is actually of ending the paparazzi completely by rendering it completely obsolete. I mean, it's how a lot of these technologies move forward. Let's do a little creative brainstorming here. So what about a sharing economy for drones where you don't have to own a drone? Basically, you have drones circling around the air constantly. You can pull it up via your droner app. I'm coining that here and now on Decentralized. Watch for it in 10 years. And say you forgot something at home, and this is actually an example I'm taking from one of my friends who recently wrote an article on drones, kind of hypothesizing a few use cases. But say you forgot something at your home, you're, you know, in a different state even, like you left your wallet or something. Instead of driving all the way back, have a shared drone pick it up. Just rent a drone, rent one of the drones, or, you know, or ride share a drone, and have things delivered to you. Like, think about how much more efficient that would be. Not only than not owning your own drone, obviously, but then, you know, all the miles expended in, you know, ground travel and obviously in stress as well. Some really fantastic things could come out of this, and things we aren't even expecting. And that's where the fun lies with all these technologies. It is the fact that they're unpredictable and they can be used for anything. The examples I gave earlier were pretty uncreative. I mean, like rescue, commerce, they're very broad. Things like ending the paparazzi, the social effects, that's where things get really cool. Feeding the homeless via drone. Oh, I could go on and on. It's what makes this show fun and what makes these technologies really interesting.
What I think is going to be interesting, and what you just said was very true. I love the feeding the homeless with a drone. That's great. But I wonder how the blockchain is going to be involved in this, because that project by IBM using Ethereum for the Internet of Things, I think, is going to have greater ramifications than people realize. And it might be, it might take a while, but it really is something where how will these be controlled in mass? You know, will there be a human doing it, or will they be automated flight plans that are done completely, you know, via GPS, with very little human interaction? And I do think that's the future of it, where we're going to have drones that completely do their tasks without any human guidance, or minimal human guidance. And that's where, you know, you really need to think about how will this technology affect different areas, and paparazzi being one of them. I mean, I'm sure celebrities are going to be just as pissed off that drones are following them around as, you know, people were. And I bet they'll even be more likely to destroy the drone, but because, you know, they can destroy a piece of hardware way easier than they can punch a guy in the face and then get a lawsuit. But it's really something that's so new. And I really do wish that whenever the stories in the media came out, that they highlighted more the positive things that are happening because of it, rather than just people. It's always an invasion of privacy. And it's quite often people that, I don't know about you, but when I grew up, once I kind of hit the internet age, I first got the internet when I was like 12 or 13, I kind of expected my privacy would no longer exist, right? I thought that if I'm out in public, I'm probably filmed. There were things, and I remember in my high school, there were things no one believed were cameras. I'm like, no, that's a camera. And no one believed it. They saw, said, no, it's a fire alarm sensor. I'm like, no, it's a camera. And they were cameras. It's pretty easy to say now. And no one believed me, but they were there. And I was like, and it doesn't bother me. Like, if you have nothing to hide, you're fine. But if you have something to hide, it does create that weird issue of privacy. And I believe in privacy greatly, but I think there's a difference between expecting privacy in your own home versus expecting privacy when you're in a public area that a drone can film you at. If you're walking down the street, I don't think you should have any expectation of privacy. Now, if you're in your own home, absolutely. And if you're in someone else's home, you have no right to that because it's their home. That's their property. And it's a challenge. It really is, because it challenges mindsets and it challenges a lot of different things. And back to my original point, because I kind of got off topic, how will the blockchain influence this? I think it could greatly. I really do. And it makes me wonder, you know, what will happen involving the two technologies in the future, because drones completely can be decentralized completely. It just needs, you know, more development on blockchain tech. It needs a faster blockchain, obviously. It needs something that will work a little faster to program routes and everything like that. But it really has giant, giant ramifications, and we don't know what they all are. And, you know, I love that you're like, let's do brainstorming. And I'm trying to think of other ways drones can be used. And delivery, I think, is the best example, and rescue situations. I really do. But I think exploration of Earth is a huge one, too, because there are a lot of places that humans have not been, or humans have minimally been, where, you know, if a machine breaks down, it's a lot less cost than if a human breaks down. Think about the Mars rover, right? That's technically a drone. And look at how much information we've gotten from the Mars rover. And if you're thinking of that as a drone, think about how fast the technology is evolving and what are the planets we can remotely just explore and learn about things. Really cool, really neat. I don't know. The one thing I wish the government would pour money into is NASA, actually. It's like the one thing that they actually, I think, did a pretty decent job with. Other than that, I don't know. But at least there was money going into it. And now there's less and less. And there's all these privatized companies, which I hope are really going to bring it to the next step. And they're going to be the ones like saying, hey, I want to explore Neptune. I want to explore, you know, although it's gassy, it's not going to be easy to explore. It can be explored. How do those things work, right? And those need better energy sources. They need a lot of different things. So it really is something where everyone, I think, when they think of the future, thinks of the Jetsons, right? They think of the things they see on TV as the future. In reality, the future moves a lot slower, right? There's not going to be hover cars anytime soon. That doesn't mean they're not going to exist. That just means they're not going to happen as soon as everyone thinks. If you kind of think about things in the long term, a lot of the things people predicted 100 years ago came true. A lot of them didn't. That doesn't mean they won't in another 100 years, does it? And that's interesting to me. That's really interesting. That's what we're talking about, because if one person gets inspired to work on something like this, then it's all, that's what helps it exist, right? And that's really all we can ask for.
Once again, I'm going to make a citation I'm going to botch completely, as I botched it earlier. But I think there's an abolitionist, Horace Greeley, made the argument back in like the 1860s, 1850s, that gradualism in theory is perpetuity in practice, perhaps, that like, if we move by small steps, we never really get to where we're going. I think it applies here, that if we dream really big, you know, like people dreamt back maybe in the 50s, 40s, 60s of what the sci-fi future of 2000 would look like. We get much further than if we didn't, even if we don't get our hover cars and hoverboards, which, by the way, hoverboards released by Lexus apparently this week. I don't know if I believe it yet. It's pretty fantastic. But that point aside, because I know I'm exciting Tony on this, and we'll have to talk about it after the show or on future episodes. I think again, it's that combination of imagination and trying to foresee the future that motivates us, but also the humility, perhaps, to realize that we don't even know what it's going to be like. Like I would actually say that, you know, in many ways, it's the future's advance faster than we've anticipated. It's just we're not looking in the right places. We're not looking in the right places because we sort of imagine we can design it or design the future of our dreams, when oftentimes it surprises us in really fun ways. And that is a joy, I think, of this kind of endeavor.
Interesting you use the word endeavor, right, when we're talking about space. But you're right. It's imagination, and people's minds, need to be think bigger. I don't think there's anything as thinking too big. And I miss that there's not as many public mad scientists out there. I think the idea of someone who has a ridiculous goal that they're aiming toward and really working their asses off to it really, really, really is an important thing. And with that being said, there's so many interesting things, and we're going to be talking to our guest, John Buttry, in a minute, one of my oldest friends, about drones and his involvement with 3D robotics and really what they're using with them, what they're using drones for now in the present. And that's, you know, you need to know what they're using them for now so you can know what they're using them for next. And he's really going to bring a lot of interesting topics and a lot of interesting thoughts about how they're being used now and how they're being used for everyone's benefit now, you know, involving movies especially. So that this will be really interesting, and we'd like to bring you over to talk to John.
We're here with one of my oldest friends, Jonathan Mayo Buttry, who is from 3D Robotics and has also done some amazing motion design work for projects that I've been involved in the past, and just wanted to have him on and talk a little bit about what he's doing. So how are you doing, John?
Good. Thanks, Tony. Thanks, James. Thanks, guys, for having me on. I'm doing great. I'm here at 3D Robotics in Austin, Texas. Another awesome day. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely. The first question I wanted to ask is, what exactly does a motion designer do? And we'll kind of go into that before we go into the 3D robotics stuff.
Definitely. At its core, you are somebody who has to communicate. So you have to know what the tools are that you have to speak with. You have to know who you're talking to and the appropriate way to talk to them. And I think most motion designers start off as either graphic designers or photographers or doing print work. And if you kind of are wired for that, like being a constant sponge and soaking up data, never being satisfied and always looking for more, all those things kind of come together to become motion design, which is essentially graphic design but animated to tell stories. So you use tools, like you need to know your traditional graphic design in terms of how colors work, how type works, how they interact, how photography works, but also how video works, how 3D works and interacts with that, and everything in between. So anything that moves on a screen from 3D animation to video to special effects to animated type, the more you can use those things and be skilled in those things, the better motion designer you'll be. For instance, the work that I've done with Tony on Augur and BitPay was clear that, you know, it requires you to look at that tool set and say what would be appropriate to talk to this audience. So coming up with like an animated infographic to explain something that's very complex and keep it entertaining and fast-paced and digestible kind of gets over the hurdle of explaining to somebody, you know, what these high-level concepts are and having them drop off quickly. So sometimes projects call for video. I do a lot of video and post-production here at 3ER. And other times projects call for full 3D animation, and I am obsessed with all things that fall into anywhere between those things.
So tell us a little bit about kind of the history of this field and this art, especially maybe during your involvement in it. How has it changed, and how has technology kind of helped propel it along, this particular kind of work?
Yeah, technology has been a huge part of it. The history kind of goes back to things like film titles. There's a guy named Saul Bass who did some really interesting film titles, kind of when you think of like the old James Bond type stuff, like the old Psycho movie, things like that, where you have this concept now of graphic treatments for film that kind of tee up the story or have some foreshadowing and using shapes and imagery to kind of kick off a story. That was kind of the beginning of mixing it. And I mean, it totally flows over into animation. So you could also make an argument that, you know, like the stuff Walt Disney did, Steamboat Willie, that has parts of it. But really when computers kind of came along and allowed people to animate and create and composite things, that's when you kind of hit that critical curve where it's more accessible to people, and people start using these tools, and they grow in step, and they become easier and easier to use. Now, that being said, there's a lot of things you can do in terms of kind of stock out of the box like templates and software stuff that looks really good, but for any kind of approach, I mean, you kind of think of it as like storytelling. So if I'm going to tell a specific story about something that's like customized to a specific audience, you can't use anything like canned. You can't use presets or plugins. Like, everything has to be informed. And when you look at, you know, all the projects that I do, I take a lot of pride in trying to put as much thought and do them as possible, and as much, you know, custom treatments to where everything is informed and intentional to explain something or weave you along or tease something up or you know, whatever the story calls for. So computers have made that a lot easier and more accessible, but it's really the core of anything, you know, advertising or marketing related, is like the messaging and the tone. And those are types of things that, you know, as much as people try, you can never create boxed solutions for those, you know. So there's a lot of care that goes into it. And that's the fun stuff, you know.
It's really interesting. It seems like motion design is kind of a medium for our times, and that it is, like you say, it seems to be very customizable. It's not something where you can be very lazy at, it seems. Like, you really do have to put a lot of care into it, as you say, and it's about, it's kind of creating a much more involving experience, and that seems to be something people demand.
Definitely.
And
I think you have people that are wired for that. Like, I'm obsessed with everything around me at all times. Like, if I'm indoors, I'll look at, you know, pieces of hardware and like the industrial design behind that, or I'll look at like, you know, a wall and be like, cool, what do they use, metal studs or aluminum studs, and how much space is between them and why, and structural integrity. And if I go outside, I'm like marveling at the fact that like, oh, this tree's been here for hundreds of years and seen more than I have. Or cool, look at the sun, it's a giant flaming exploding ball that has its own gravitational pull that's hurtling us around it, and then we get the moon in our gravitational pull and it just all exists. And like, I'm just constantly fascinated by everything around me, and that kind of lends your point of view to motion design. Like, if you combine graphic design, photography, video, post-production, and all roll that into a tool set that can be used for storytelling, like, dude, I'm never going to get bored in my entire life. Like, that's a tool set that will constantly grow and that will constantly stimulate somebody who is obsessed with everything around them and the mechanics of how it works and wants to soak that up and use it as tools to communicate things that I'd like to communicate or stories I'd like to tell. I think there's kind of like two parties. You have people that are like, yeah, I have this thought and this voice, and I want to, like, you know, write my own scripts and get my own movies and stuff like that out there. And I think that's like a lot of the, where, you know, you have a lot of directors kind of going that route. But for me, I'm just personally more interested knowing that, you know, when you're marketing a product, you kind of have a built-in audience. You have people that are going to be interested in this thing. And you know that if you make content, you are going to be directly interfacing it with them. So to me, it's like the difference between like going out on a street corner and singing a song to whoever's listening, to like showing up to a room that's just packed with people, knowing that you have a message to deliver, and that's more exciting to me personally. I think it's neat.
And I think in regards to what you just said, it involves the videos that you did for Augur and for BitPay, specifically the Augur video, which has been very successful lately. Very successful. I can't say how good of a job you did on that. And I'm curious about when you mentioned about box solutions and how they don't work. I think that's actually the case in a lot of things, you know, being involved in marketing, and that there's a habit, because it's easier to just go with that and say, okay, I'm going to do this. This is the way it's done. And let's just do that, and it'll work. And usually it doesn't. And it's something where, you know, when did you learn that? Was that something you knew from the beginning, or was that something that you kind of saw as you studied other, you know, pieces of work, other advertisements, other videos, other just content in general?
I think you learn those principles early on, and a lot of those principles are present in graphic design. Like, my history is in everything from print collateral to direct mail, where it's like, cool, you have one image and one headline and then some body copy, and you need to make your point in that. And so you kind of get like, how much can you squeeze out of that? But when you put that on a timeline, and now you have linear storytelling, like, you can infinitely customize that to say exactly what you want to say in a more crafted way. Like for the Augur video, and this is kind of the specialty that I've carved out in the last few years, has been working with companies in different parts of the tech space, from drones to the computer-aided sniper rifles to decentralized, you know, BitPay and Augur, where it's my job to first be a good listener, and I have to understand the product good enough to tell the story. Like, if I know how to explain Augur good enough to create a story that can explain it to other people and keep it entertaining, but any level beyond that, if you ask me, like, what's going on under the hood of Augur, I couldn't explain it all. So it's like walking this fine line as a marketer, saying I need to know what I'm talking about good enough to inform other people, but my job isn't to be an expert on the mechanics of it. It's to tell that story and bring people along. So for the Augur video, it was super interesting, the fact that Tony had this connection in Shooter Jennings, which is like completely unconventional for a voiceover in terms of, you know, like a country singer explaining a decentralized tech concept. But to me, like, that's what makes it exciting, because if you hear that, it's not going to be like, oh, it's like every other, you know, video on Kickstarter where it's filmed on white, because that's how Apple does it. And it's like, really nice coaxing voice explains a concept and makes it seem attainable. Like, no, dude, we're going to get Shooter Jennings, who sings country music, and like have him sit back as if you were enjoying a beer on a porch and explain to you what Augur is. And we're going to have these really like graphics that kind of carry you through it, and it's going to be pretty informative, to where like when you finish it, you feel like you just had like a nice glass of iced tea with Shooter Jennings, and now you know about, you know, decentralized marketplace prediction. Like, that's pretty unique. And to that statement, I mean, there's a lot of noise out there from a lot of companies that are selling vaporware or concepts, or just trying to be like, okay, I'm sure you guys see it all the time in the decentralization world, where like decentralization exists, the blockchain exists, you have all these people wanting to create companies based off of that, but they just want to kind of take advantage for you know what it is and slap whatever they do into that mold because it's a new like hot word or a new, you know, market or a new audience for them. But it's, to me, having the companies that are trying to do something thoughtful or meaningful or both are the ones that have more of a story to tell. So like those canned solutions, and I think like it varies from industry to industry. Like for web, for instance, if you're going to launch a website, you don't go learn CSS, you go find a WordPress template, and then you hit a few buttons and you can build a database and host it. For web, that kind of works, because, not in all instances, but because like your content is king and you don't need to like reinvent some Flash site where like the cursor is like a ripple of water to try and tell your story. You can do that through text and images. But for video, it's a little more involved than that, because it's taking place on a timeline. You kind of have to be, you have to do something that cuts through the noise. And I think that's where marketing, like we know what kind of marketing is templated and works now, but to do effective marketing and good marketing, you have to be kind of self-aware of that and a little more clever to cut through the noise.
It's a really interesting story, especially based on kind of what we were talking about prior to the call, which is you're kind of really telling me you don't really have too much of a background in decentralized technology. Can you tell us a little bit about that and maybe what your background kind of is in the companies you work with? Because you've worked with some really cool companies, as your sniper rifle comment hinted at.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of decentralized companies or companies that work off the blockchain, I mean, I always think Tony's story is pretty amazing, how he kind of got paired up with the right community. And I mean, I could talk about so many parts of this for so long, but I guess the whole idea, which covers like not only to me, like where, how Tony broke into that, but also how I got into what I'm doing, is like you're born into this environment that you grew up in, and either you accept like, cool, that's the size of the world and I haven't seen much or traveled much, and maybe I'll do, you know, X, Y, or Z for a living because that's like what the people I know do, or that's what their parents do. But like for somebody like Tony, who's like a sponge about everything in the world, like he's not going to settle for that. And he knows there's more out there, and he's going to find it. And similarly, like I was fascinated by the world around me, and I love learning about new things and taking on challenges, even if they're things that I don't know anything about, because my universe is going to be bigger by doing that. So when Tony first contacted me to do, originally the BitPay video was the first thing we worked on. I don't know anything about, you know, Bitcoin, but immediately I'm like, great, that's super exciting. And my skill set lends itself towards telling stories that I'm not an expert in, because I enjoy becoming expert enough to tell those stories. So I start reading about Bitcoin. I start reading about mining and blockchain and the whole history. And I have questions like, okay, it's completely transparent, but also completely anonymous. Those things seem to contradict each other. How does that work? And then Tony's like, glad you asked. And he has some amazing explanation. I'm like, man, you should be like recording this on audiobooks and selling it, because it's super informative. But so having somebody like Tony who can explain all those things helps a lot. And then once I feel like I have enough to tell the story and I understand who they're talking to, I can craft that message. In terms of other interesting companies that I've done stuff for and how I ended up at 3DR, in probably for about 10 years or so, I worked in agencies or marketing companies in one capacity or another. And when you're in those kinds of worlds, oops, hold on. Sorry, my tab exited. Am I still on? Okay, cool. Sorry about that. You're basically handed accounts. Like one of the agencies I worked at in Atlanta specialized in, when I started there, they specialized in sports. So they had like the Atlanta Braves and the Thrashers and the Hawks. And I know how basketball and baseball generally work. If you're going to be advertising, you need to be an expert. So you learn about, you know, players and what makes them unique and their connections to people. And I worked with a guy who, at that agency, who ended up taking a job at a gun company that makes, they called them precision-guided firearms, which was essentially a computer on a rifle. And the computer was pretty powerful, had like a Wi-Fi server in it, and it would calculate ballistic solutions to where you could essentially tap a button and the bullet would go up to 1,200 yards, pretty much exactly where you wanted it to go. So if you've never shot a gun before, you can shoot better than the world's best sniper. That was kind of their marketing claim, and they were able to back it up in a lot of interesting ways. I wasn't really a gun guy, and I didn't know much about guns, but I was confident enough in, you know, marketing and storytelling to where I would move, you know, halfway across the country and immerse myself in that world, and it was pretty amazing. A lot of the things that you would think about, you know, gun-wielding Texans aren't really true. They're pretty open-minded, amazing people. And so doing things like that, I'm much, much more interested in expanding my own comfort zones and telling stories for other people than just saying, like, here's my values, here's what I'm committed to, here's my world, and I'm just going to scream about, you know, what I believe in and what I stand for until I die. I would rather be this, like, pliable piece of clay that has this amazing experience participating in, you know, all these parts of the world that I think are really interesting and amazing. So I did a lot for that gun company, and when 3D Robotics came along, some of the people from that company had moved to 3D Robotics, and they knew my work, and they brought me on board to help out with the launch of their main project, which is a smart drone, which is out now. And a little backstory, I guess, on 3D Robotics. Chris Anderson, who was the editor of Wired, was very into drones and knew that there would be things going on in that space. And he kind of found through the internet and message boards and kind of DIY channels, back channels, that there was somebody named Jordi in Mexico who was designing his own flight code. And they basically partnered up and started 3DR as just two people, and they built it into a company of almost 400 people, partnering with some people who came from bigger drone companies, and they're basically taking the angle that software is the key to drones and unlocking their potential, and that being open source and transparent and participating directly with the users and offering the great customer experience and user experience are things that people care about. And the interesting thing for me is I had flown drones before to capture footage and on video shoots and things like that. But basically, they're taking the pilot element out of it. You no longer need to know how to pilot a drone in order to get amazing footage. And similar to the way you don't need to know how to use, you know, a complicated computer to run a smartphone, it's very app-driven. So you can get these shots that you know, the best drone pilots in the world couldn't get by pushing one button on your phone. And they're doing that all through computers, and it's all open source. So they have a lot of open source implications that I think are really neat, some of which are, I'm trying to think of the formal name. It's basically a program where you can develop products, accessories for the drone, bring them to market, and we will help you with the production of them and marketing of them, but you'll own the IP, things like that. Also being open source, having like a, whatever it is, a 30-pin, whatever, bay on the belly of the drone that you can essentially tap into and make your own products or, you know, run your own software or hardware or ideas on. I think that's really, really awesome.
Absolutely. With all that said, thank you very much for the compliments as well. Is there any information you can get to people that are involved in that specifically? At the end, we'll let you kind of plug the other projects, but let's say someone's interested in a project involving 3D robotics and wants to access the code. They want to access information of how to get started. Where would you recommend going?
Their website, I think, has some of the information that you would need to do that. But I mean, they're a pretty transparent company. Like if you write on their Facebook wall, somebody in our office that's connected to all of us will see it. And if you are somebody that's currently using drones to do amazing things, we've probably already contacted you and offered to do some kind of partnership or give you products to try out. I mean, it's very, very connected. And for instance, like when we did our big launch at a trade show, we had people just hanging out at the booth that were interested. And because they were interested, they now work for us. So I mean, it's one of the most connected and transparent companies I've seen in terms of if you're passionate and good at what you do, about what you do, it's very easy for you to get plugged in and for us to know who you are, and very connected environment, which is exciting. In terms of building products, it's a pretty small circle. So most people who are building things for drones are using what's called Pixhawk, which is our flight controller. Like 90% of the drones you see that are one-offs, like that Lily drone that was super popular because of their Kickstarter, and almost any other drone that you see that's not some big commercial brand, is using our flight controller. They're using our software. They're using our hardware to run their flight code. So we are insanely plugged into that environment in terms of being a part of it, and anybody who's building on drones is already probably using our hardware and software and knows who we are and how to get a hold of us.
It sounds like an amazing company, and you were actually just showing us around through your camera, your webcam, actually what the office looks like and everyone working and playing ping pong and stuff like that. Great environment, and it sounds like, you know, you're getting the right people, present company included. So one question I had, I guess, is that you've mentioned sort of some of the areas which people are using your software, other drone makers, sometimes movie makers. What kind of verticals are you seeing as being the most popular popular ones for using drones? Here we go. See, that users can say hi to the 3D robotics people. Very nice.
Yeah.
Thank you. Chris is giving us a tour right now. Jonathan's giving us a tour.
So you're asking what other areas would be using drones? I mean, there's a lot. I mean, every day you hear stories about people using drones for good, whether it's, you know, dropping off supplies to flood areas or using it to survey things. And essentially, we are most interested in being the company that can build the foundation for whatever that is going to hold, whether it's, you know, surveying farms for crops or creating video content that explores or, you know, communicates things and anything in between. I mean, there's crazy inventions and uses like putting an infrared camera on it to check for gas leaks or inspecting power lines, you know, all the way to, you know, just, you know, all kinds of crazy uses. So the fact that we are owning the space as much as possible, where whatever the future holds for drones, whether it's Amazon delivery or anything in between, that will be built on our software and flight code and things like that. So that's kind of the long game. In terms of, you know, areas where that's happening now, basically the Solo, 3DR Solo, which is the drone that we released this year and is now in Best Buy, B&H, that's our main consumer product that we're pushing. And the cool thing about that is we've used computers because we've partnered with you know, or been backed by companies like Qualcomm that makes, you know, the chips in your cell phone. So we can add more processors. We can put computers in the drone and the controller and do things that no other drone can do, like set keyframes in space and do curves that interpolate and use logarithms to, like, ease in and out of those curves. And you can play a flight path like you would an iTunes song with a pause button and a rewind button and things like that. So taking the piloting out of it and basically saying, like, if you want to create content, you can use this as a tool. You know, similar to how 10 years ago there weren't a lot of people who were photographers, but if you put a camera on a phone and create a platform to share that with your friends, now everybody's posting, you know, hundreds of photos a day, a week, whatever it is, because you made those tools accessible, taken the curve out, and put them in the hands of people that have a platform to use them on. So we're looking to do that with drones, and so far the results have been pretty amazing and lots of fun to participate in.
Speaking of the results, recently you spent some time in Malta. Can you go into a little bit of what you did there?
I can a little bit. Actually, we the first half of our time, the days in Malta, we put out a video for 3DR. Basically, me and two other guys from 3DR rented ATVs and drove all around, just, you know, like bats out of hell, and filmed a bunch of amazing landscape stuff. And then the main reason we went there was Michael Bay was filming a movie called 13 Hours, which is about Benghazi. And through some connections, we were asked to, you know, show him Solo and basically how it works on a film set, and had various levels of involvement showing him that and participating. That I can't go into too much detail. When the movie gets closer to coming out, we will have some pretty interesting video content that I think people will really like and be surprised at. But I guess the takeaway would be knowing that the same product you get off the shelf at Best Buy can have a place on a multi-million dollar film set and hold its own and do things that nothing else can is really, really exciting. And that's kind of the big takeaway. But yeah, it was awesome. We got to meet Michael Bay and show him how to fly, and he had us participate various levels. So that was a great trip. We went to Hawaii for 10 days to film the launch materials for Solo. I just got back from Mexico City, where we're, you know, getting up with a bunch of our producers who live in Mexico and attaching Solos to surfboards and putting them in trash bags and swimming through sea caves to get to hidden beaches so we can film them at sunrise and all kinds of just super fun adventure stuff. And that, you know, that's one of the more exciting things about working for a drone company is you can't film ugly stuff. So we're always traveling to really great looking places and having adventures because, I mean, that's what, you know, who wouldn't want to do that with drones? That's why you would get a drone and what you'd like to do with it. So yeah, lots of adventures. Much more to come.
So two questions, Jonathan. Are you hiring? No, I'm joking. I'm happily employed, but it sounds wonderful. And
I think I've been with 3DR only about 7-8 months now, and they've hired about 200 people since I've started. So the company's doubled in size in much less than a year. So if, especially if you're a developer or engineer, or and you have any kind of specialty, whether it's in user experience or software design, yes, we are always looking for talented people.
All right, perfect. Listeners, you heard it. You know how to be creative and get in contact with 3DR and show your passion and your skills for it. So second question, kind of before we wrap up, and we'll definitely want to get some information sort of where people can find you as well. But really kind of a broader level question is, how do you think technology projects can kind of use some of these principles of motion design and some of these really cool technologies, things like drones and drone filming, to more effectively reach people? One of the things we see a lot is decentralized technology projects. You know, they're really, really cool technologies, but they have a hard time actually getting users because they're just kind of stuck away in some corner of the internet. How do you see, as a motion designer, how projects like maybe Augur or BitPay or whoever else you've worked with can get better exposure?
I think by using the very medium alone, you've already automatically widened your user base. And because every field is more connected, whether it's, you know, the world of decentralization or people who care about Blockcoin, like for instance with the Augur video, using somebody like Shira Jennings and using animated infographics to tell it, all of a sudden that matters to people who are in the infographics community, which might sound like a small community, but there's a lot of us, and also people who are interested in country music, like, you know, and that's the kind of thing where I think the internet is, the whole, like, clickbait formula is very centered on, like, 2 to 3 overlapping things. Like, if it's an article, like, why is country legend Shooter Jennings talking about decentralized, you know, market prediction? That's like, you know, okay, I'm somewhat interested in why that might be happening. Whereas if you only use your traditional channels, you're talking to your audience. You're only talking to, you know, the audience that you have built in. And the other way to increase that audience would just be through effective marketing. The fact that we have all the data that we can garnish at our fingertips from every device that everyone's using, from your laptop to your phone that's with you at all the time. We know your location. We know everything you look at. Not me personally, but I'm saying all that data is available, and we're finally learning what to do with it. Like a few years ago, you had the rise of analytics companies where all of a sudden, especially paired with the recession, when these giant budgets started getting slashed, analytics companies could tell you exactly where your money was going, how effective it was in terms of, you know, how it comes back to you, return on investment, all that sort of thing. And then I felt like the pendulum kind of swung the other way. It's like you know all that with analytics. You can make decisions with analytics, but without the creative aspect, you're just getting data, and you're becoming like the whole, you're becoming like 1984, and the fact is you need both of those to work together. So using creative storytelling like motion graphics, which kind of encompasses anything that moves that you would want to communicate to somebody, along with data to tell you who you're actually talking to, that's a pretty deadly marketing combination in terms of finding the people and getting them a message that they care about, and it informs your decision. Like some of this stuff, when I started researching, you know, Ethereum and the blockchain, it was a lot of people who lived and breathed that stuff talking to people who are also fascinated by it. And they were using concepts that quickly, I mean, I felt lost in about 30 seconds. So in the projects I did for Tony, knowing that I need to communicate this in a way that anybody could watch it for like a minute, 2 minutes, and not feel lost and feel included and feel like, wow, this complicated concept is actually pretty easy. And that's happening in motion design. It's also happening in graphic design. Like Tony posted a great infographic the other day, which was explaining how Ether worked or Ethereum worked in like simple way. And whenever you see those things, they seem so obvious. Like, well, of course that makes sense. But I mean, that takes a skilled designer who understands the concept, understands communication, and has the tools to distill that concept into something that feels so digestible. So I mean, having that tool set, knowing who you're talking to, knowing the story that you're telling, that's how you use design or motion design or any kind of design to have communication that's entertaining, effective, informative, and that people will watch outside of the circle that you're in.
Awesome. Thank you so much for doing the show, man. I really appreciate it. And we also wanted to give you a chance to, you know, plug your Twitter, plug 3D Robotics, the website, where people can learn about your projects and everything about you and what you're doing.
Yeah, 3DRobotics.com is where you can find Solo and any 3D Robotics projects. I'm not super active on Twitter. My website is jbcmotion.com, or if you just Google jbcmotion, a lot of my content's on Vimeo and things like that. I'm extremely, extremely, extremely busy, but occasionally I do take on additional products if they're for rad people like Tony doing super rad things. But thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on, and have a good one.
You too.
It's been another really fun episode on Decentralized, but I did want to tell our listeners today, this is actually my last episode, and I'm quite glad to have wrapped it up with such a fun one. It's a great discussion with Tony and with Jonathan. I've been on the show for 30 episodes now, and it's been one of the best experiences of my life, actually. As some of you may know, podcasting was kind of like one of my childhood dreams that I've accomplished early on. And I definitely intend to come back to it, but I'm moving on to some other projects that I really want to devote my time and real passion to. Things which have been enhanced by this podcast, and things which I've discovered and learned through, and things that, you know, initially brought me to this podcast, which is working with Tony. And Tony was the one to initially invite me on the show. And for that, I'm really grateful, and I wanted to thank you, Tony, for this experience. And thank all of you listeners, too, because... again, you've let me do something I've always wanted to do. and you've let me to do it well. And with a topic that, you know, though I'm new to, I've learned so much about, and I've surprised myself and met some really cool people in the process.
All I can say about that is thank you. It's sad to see you go. The door is always welcome at Decentralized for James. You've been an absolute wonderful person to have on this. And with that being said, one of the first things I think one of the things I said to you after I got to know you is one day you're going to be taking over the world. And I still maintain that. There's so many things you brought to this as far as just bringing your own thoughts and bringing, regardless if you agreed with me or Eric or anyone else who's on the show, you were going to come with whatever you truly believed in. And that I respect ultimately over anything else, because it's something it's in your heart and it's in what you believe and you can't change that. And I, no matter what it is, if I disagree or not, I love it. I love that attitude. And I really, you know, Decentralized is still going to go on, but it's something where it won't be the same without you. And I'm hoping that in the future we can have you back on via a surprise guest once in a while. I don't think this is the end of this, but I think it's the end for now. I really do love that everything you brought to this table for this podcast, it's been absolutely wonderful. I can't say enough positive things from organization, which is something that I know I lack, that you're just great at. And you've shown that with every other project you work in. And when I've worked with you at BitPay, your organization is top notch and it's only going to get better. So I really think whatever you decide to do is going to be very, very positive. And whatever next path and next decision you make and the next projects you're working on, they're all going to be great. So I just wanted to say that it's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned so much with you and from you. And it's if you can't say you learned something from someone, then what do you do? And you've taught me so much. So I do want to say thank you. I'm sure our audience just feels this exact same way, that you've been an absolute blessing to the show. So thank you. And I wish you luck on every single project you have in the future. And however we can help here on Decentralized, or I can help personally, feel free to just reach out and we're here.
Oh, man, thank you so much for those kind words. And you've been very kind throughout this whole process. And listeners have been great. This is a really important conversation we're having on the show. And it's not just us having it, obviously, and we are just, you know, a group of guys. It's elevated the conversation for us. It's made us really focus and learn. I think, especially me, I can speak for myself here. If you remember early episodes, Decentralizers, I was very awkward and very shy. Maybe I still am. Maybe now I'm just, too talkative, but, it's an important conversation we're having. It's about, at least for me, it's about freedom. And it is about, you know, maybe it's a better world with more creative and free people within it. And how all these technologies we look at on the show, can make you more free and let you do what you want to do with your life. So, you know, go get a drone, go fly it around, go give the drone a spin in my honor. No, again, thank you all. And, continue to learn about this and continue to check out this show, check out other shows and continue your education. It's something that's been very helpful to me and I intend to do so. Sort of to close up here, I would love to continue to interact with any of you who are interested in talking about decentralized technologies. I don't tend to stop there. So feel free to reach out to me at James L. Walpole on Twitter. And I will certainly see you all out there in the decentralized world we're building and that this show is all about.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm. or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.